And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's a debate being waged within the wilderness preservation movement as to what really is the future of America's wilderness. Some would have it that in order to make progress in such politically contentious times, we need to make compromises to continue the movement forward. But there are those who contend that the protections afforded wilderness by the Wilderness Act must be defended as inviolate. We'll take a walk on that wild side and then bring you the latest on new sightings of that elusive ivory-billed woodpecker. It's your voice of the earth, the Wild Side News, coming right up.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Now here's something I think you need to know. Sometime between now and the not too distant future, the population of the United States will reach 300 million people. It's amazing how these numbers creep up on us. You know, we each pride ourselves in what we know. And in the past, there are certain population numbers that I've quoted as authoritative. If someone asked me growing up what the population was, I'd say 175 million. Seemed then like a lot of people, but is always small compared to India or China with their hundreds of millions. Then the next number that seems to stick is 235 million, which I find was reached in around 1984. And then there seemed to be these gaps, and the next number that seemed to emerge was around 276 million, which is where I thought we were, but actually, that's a 1990 figure, which I probably paid attention to as a census year figure. So, depending on whom you listen to, that 300 million figure is supposed to occur fairly soon. 300 million sounds pretty impressive, although it's just a drop in the genetic bucket on the planet right now, but it's a definitive figure and a landmark. We achieved 200 million around 1968. So it's no wonder then that we who've been talking about the usurpation of open spaces are witnessing, in fact, the effects of population growth. I just got back from a trip to Phoenix, and I'm amazed at how that new urban megaplex just keeps being filled in with new houses and shopping malls. And yet, on the drive between San Diego and Phoenix, quite honestly, when you get into the hot lands in eastern California and western Arizona, it's hard to tell which way the population is going. There's still plenty of small towns that are still small, with those strange abandoned dream homes and shops that clutter the fringes on the main streets at the end of town. Seems no one wants to live in them, not even the Mexicans. But the problems of population are being felt generally throughout any temperate climate, particularly here in the United States. And that directly relates to the two topics on today's show. The pressures on public lands, particularly wilderness, are coming to a head as populations grow to the very outskirts of the wild. And many people feel these ancient lands deserve ultimate protection, as provided in the 1964 Wilderness Act. Now, some feel the pressures are forcing the need for a compromise with the forces of growth to assure that we can achieve some of our wilderness goals, particularly as the powers that be use some kind of manifest legerdemain to grab as much as they can right now. But others, as you'll see today, feel differently and staunchly defend the original intent and letter of wilderness laws. It's one of those questions each of us will have to choose where we stand. And it's becoming increasingly difficult to straddle the fence as these two visions drift farther and farther apart. We talk today with George Nickus, Director of Wilderness Watch, in segments 2 and 3. But first, a great breaking story from the swamps and deep woods of Florida, where there have been a series of new sightings and recordings that give hope to the dream that the ivory-billed woodpecker lives in a wider region than originally thought. Based on the current approach coming out of Auburn University, it should be only a matter of time before we know, once and for all, if the ivory woodpecker is back. That's all coming up. But first, the news. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is pumping up his environmental credentials this week as he signed into law a sweeping global warming initiative that imposes the nation's first cap on greenhouse emissions. Joined by San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, New York Governor George Pataki, and by video link Prime Minister Tony Blair, the governor made a strong case for committing California to protect its environment and in the process create jobs and set a standard that the rest of the world can follow. As other administration officials make lengthy pleas to ignore the ridiculous claims that global warming is real, Schwarzenegger was stating, "Nothing is more important than protecting our planet." Seems there's something in the air that is causing politicos to speak their minds and take a strong stand. Perhaps it's the scent of the elections that puts a little spring in the spines of the powerful. The global warming bandwagon is getting quite crowded as more and more notables jump in and get ready to ride. That bigger-than-life British business wizard Richard Branson has pledged to commit all of the profits from his transportation companies over the next 10 years to fight global warming. Expected to reach $3 billion in that time span, Branson made this astonishing commitment at the Clinton Global Initiative this last week, which raised a total of $7 billion for global initiatives to create a healthier and more just world. Joining that effort was media mogul and conservative billionaire Rupert Murdoch. Branson said the profits will be invested in efforts to find renewable, sustainable energy sources to counter the reliance on oil, gas, and fossil fuels that are tied to the increasing carbon dioxide emissions. With Clinton at his side, Branson stated, "Our generation has inherited an incredibly beautiful world from our parents, and they from their parents. We must not be the generation responsible for irreversibly damaging the environment." Well, it's a bit late for that. But here we are, and we are finding a new global mission that just may overshadow the specter of terror, or maybe not. But we need to keep trying. Meanwhile, as NASA's Jim Hansen of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies said in New York City this week, that the Earth appears to be at the warmest point it has been in 1 million years, the journal Nature reported that a government agency blocked release of a government report by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that suggests that global warming is contributing to the frequency and strength of hurricanes. This way and that way go the charges, but this too is likely to pass, as critical mass is getting behind the momentum for a global effort to address the global warming issue. In New Delhi, representatives from the Wildlife Protection Society of India held a news conference to announce that the Bengal tiger may have only a handful of years yet to exist. Placing blame directly on the governments of India and China, which are not acting to curb the increasing demand for tiger parts to enhance virility, make interesting conversation pieces in fancy new homes, and more, the Environmental Investigation Agency stated that in China, police have decided to turn a blind eye to the slaughter of tigers in India, which fuels the lucrative trade in endangered animals, which is run by highly organized networks to provide souvenirs and Chinese medicine. They forewarned in their statement that we need to start imagining a world without the great predators. And finally, Captain Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society has announced a campaign to raise $3 million to purchase a new ship to head into the cold waters off the coast of Antarctica to take direct action against illegal whale hunters from Japan. With plans to head out in December, Captain Watson invites you to do the necessary and visit www.operationleviathan.org. That's www.operationleviathan.org. And that's the news. There's been some great stories coming out in the realms of science, and certainly one that has been most exciting as it relates to endangered species and populations and trends. was a story that came out last year about the potential rediscovery, which is an ongoing story, of the elusive ivory-billed woodpecker that was considered extinct for about 40 years, although if you check the field guides, they always had the pictures, and they always said thought to be extinct. And so now there's some evidence that keeps mounting that the ivory-billed woodpecker is not extinct. And now there's a brand new story that's coming out from the swamps and lowlands of Florida about a potential, well, quite a bit of evidence that there may be a population or birds in an area of Florida. And the lead scientist on this, who has reported his findings in the Avian Conservation and Ecology Journal, is Dr. Jeffrey Hill with Auburn University, who is joining us now. Dr. Hill, welcome to the Wild Side.
Yeah, Jeff is fine, and thank you. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Well, this is a fascinating story. I'm just curious, when you heard about the first sightings of the ivory-billed woodpecker, what were your thoughts, the first ones from Arkansas?
I was excited. I'm a lifelong bird enthusiast, and I actually heard the news on NPR, along with the rest of the public, and was just very excited. It was, like everybody says, one of the most exciting bird stories I'd ever heard.
Mm-hmm. To that point, had this been an area of your interest or research?
No, actually not. Most of the scientific papers I've published have been studying the coloration of feathers on birds, although I am a good bird watcher. I can identify birds in the field, and I get out and look at birds a lot. But I had never been an ivory-billed searcher. I actually had never gone out looking for ivory-billed ever before. I teach ornithology at Auburn, and I have a couple lectures on endangered and extinct birds, and I always gave quite a bit of time to ivory-billed. And pretty much that's when I thought about them every year, when I gave my extinct bird lecture in ornithology class.
Well, what led you to Florida?
Well, so the announcement was made in Arkansas by the people at the Lab of Ornithology, and like everybody else, we were very excited. A lot of people sort of vented their excitement by going to Arkansas and trying to get a look at the bird, but I really hate sort of follow the lead of birding, running in behind people to see a bird that's already been found. I always find it a lot more enjoyable to go and explore new places and find my own stuff. So instead of going to Arkansas, some students and I just decided to go down to South Alabama and the Florida Panhandle, really just to look for habitat, just to see what sort of ivory-billed-like habitat might be around down there.
So it really was almost based on sort of a hypothesis that there may be some creatures there based on habitat.
We didn't even know the habitat. We just knew that was the historic range of the bird, and living in Alabama in the South, it's clear to me that there are very few bird watchers compared to other parts of the country, and a lot of places that never really get any attention by someone with book knowledge of birds.
That's fascinating.
So for those very vague reasons, I always held out hope ivory-billed could exist somewhere. Mm-hmm. So very large areas of the country that really never get looked at.
So when did you actually start your quest?
Well, the quest was just a weekend kayaking trip. We were all busy. I run lots of projects. You know, I've got different research investigations going. I had lots of grad students, postdocs. I was a coordinator of a very big lab group. So this was just a weekend to get out and float in our kayaks and look at birds. It was not an expedition, really, in a true sense. But we left on May 20th, a Friday, and drove down to South Alabama and spent the 20th floating the Pea River, which is a main tributary of the Chocktahatchee. And then we didn't find what we were looking for. We didn't see extensive tracts of big trees. It seemed to be a pretty degraded habitat. And sort of on a whim, we just decided to shift south down into the Florida Panhandle and spend the next day floating the Chocktahatchee.
Mm-hmm.
We had intended to spend 2 days on the Pea, but the failure to find any interesting habitat the first day just made us decide to go south and see what was down there.
So as you float along in your kayaks, what are you all watching for, looking for, and listening for?
We pretty much take it as it comes. So as we floated down the Pea River, for instance, we kept hearing American Red Starts, which is a little songbird that lives in mature forest. And we were actually taking data for the Alabama Breeding Bird Atlas, which is a project meant to determine the distributions of all birds in the state. And it turns out that detection of red starts along that river was significant because it extended the range of red start southeast of Alabama by maybe 100 miles. So we were just pretty much recording all the birds that we saw or heard as we moved along these rivers.
But then something must have happened where something caught someone's attention. How was the first, what was that first moment like when someone went, wait a second,
yeah,
what was that?
Yeah, it kind of happened slowly. So we're going down the Choctahatchee, and it was only about an hour after we launched our kayaks. We launched our kayaks just at first light, and it was a beautiful morning. We're floating along, and we keep taking side channels off of the river. And this river has lots of side channels. So we kind of got back off the main river up into the swamp forest. And when the water comes up in the river, the water just literally flows right into the forest. The whole forest can be like a lake.
Hmm.
And we were paddling through little channels in the trees, and we heard this loud banging up in the canopy.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of birds can bang on a tree. So it wasn't like we fell out of our boats thinking it's banging. It was just kind of one of those things, huh, wonder what's doing that banging up in the tree. It sounds pretty loud. And so we milled around. This is a very mature forest, giant trees with a thick canopy. And this time of year, you can't see much up in the canopy of the forest. So we were kind of milling around in our kayaks trying to get a look at what was doing this banging. Brian Rolek, one of the three of us, saw a bird fly from where we'd heard this banging, and he got a good look at it. Tyler Hicks, the other guy with me, didn't see it, and I didn't see it. But when Brian described what he'd seen to us, Brian is the least experienced birder in our group. He gave a clear description of an Ivoryville woodpecker. Tyler and I were stunned that he had just seen something that matched the description of an Ivoryville woodpecker.
So he must have described a very large bird. I've certainly seen pileateds,
yeah.
And that's a good-sized bird.
That's
a very impressive bird. It looks like a flying dinosaur.
That's right.
But the ivory-billed apparently is significantly larger than the pileated.
Yeah, but it's not like a turkey vulture-sized bird. It's bigger than pileated, you're right. But in wingspan, I think only maybe 20% bigger. It's got a heavier body. So it would be a big bird, but it's really the way it flies and the plumage pattern that really strikes you.
Well, and the only related bird would be the pileated or pileated.
Always said pileated my whole life, but yeah. I'm a self-trained birder. I birded for the first 10 years of my life by making up my own pronunciations out of a book, so I probably get them all wrong.
I'm the same way, so whatever it is. We'll say pileated for the rest of the conversation.
Well, there's an English word, I think. There is a correct pronunciation, but it's not one we use commonly to describe anything else, so I don't know maybe someone of the listeners knows correct pronunciation
of
pileated.
I've heard it both ways. I think if you want to be fancy, you say pileated.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not fancy, so I guess I'll start with pileated.
Okay. In terms of any sort of comparable bird that could be confused, the only one would be, I think...
Well, reasonably,
yeah.
If you have some skills as a bird watcher.
Yeah.
I actually had one of the ivory-bill people around the country told me of someone mistaking a Mississippi kite for an ivory-bill woodpecker,
mm-hmm.
Which, if you don't know anything about birds, it's not ridiculous. Mississippi kite has white secondaries, but everything else about that bird is so different.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody with... Even beginner birder skills would misidentify a Mississippi kite for a ivory-billed woodpecker.
Well,
you're right. For us, the only reasonable birds would be pretty much a pileated woodpecker.
Mm-hmm. What else led you to?
This isn't everything we based our announcement on. Brian's glimpse of this bird coming out of the tree.
Oh no, you've done some really terrific research. Yeah.
Yeah. So later that morning, I heard a double knock, which is the signature sound of these birds. Instead of drumming like most woodpeckers, they give a two hard bangs in the tree, bang, bang. And so I heard that. I'd never heard that before in anywhere. So that was interesting, and that was pretty much it for that first weekend. We tantalizing, but it was far from anything conclusive. So the next weekend, Brian had to get back to work on the project he was working on. Tyler and I went back to the same spot. We split up, and as Tyler was out of his boat in the forest, he had a female ivory-billed fly through the forest in front of him. and Tyler's an excellent birder, field ornithologist. He was able to raise his binoculars, follow this bird in focus in his binoculars, and get a detailed view of this bird.
Hmm. Now, what would be the differentiation between the male and female in the?
Important thing about saying it's a female is when Tyler saw this bird, he could clearly see the feathers on the bird's head, and they were black.
Mm-hmm.
Now, male ivory bill would have red crest feathers,
mm-hmm.
and both male and female pileated would have red crest feathers.
Mm-hmm.
The only large woodpecker with an all-black head is a female ivory bill.
Gotcha. Well, then your research continued, and you decided it was time to get more serious about this, and so you
That's
did
right.
some serious... What was the time frame?
Well, two things happened. So at this point, it's, say, June of 2005. The three of us, I'm the professor, and I got two students that have seen... I had yet to see it, but those guys had seen it. We had heard sounds. We had to do something. So first I went to my postdoc. We didn't tell even the other people in our lab about this. We just kept it to ourselves. But I went to my postdoctoral fellow, Dr. Dan Mennell, who was working in my lab on birdsong.
Mm-hmm.
And we told Dan what we had seen and heard so far, and we asked him if he would join the search crew to help us try to record sounds of these birds.
Now, I'm just curious on a personal level. Did he look at you like you were... Perhaps you spent a little bit too much time in the woods.
Yeah, luckily, I have some credibility with Dan. So when I told him that I was in on this and we were sure what we had, Dan was in.
Mm-hmm.
He basically put his faith in us as field observers.
Mm-hmm. Great. Mm-hmm.
So Dan was just about to move to a faculty position at the University of Windsor. And when he did that, he recruited a grad student, Kyle Swiston, who... became Dan's main helper on this. So Kyle was the fifth member of our group. And that five-member crew, we did all the work. It was Tyler Hicks, Brian Rulick, Kyle Swiston, Dr. Dan Mennell, and me were the search crew. Okay, so once we had that, we needed some funding. And I went to my dean. So we didn't have enough to go to a federal agency or state agency and try to... asked for funding because we had almost nothing at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to my dean and asked if he would have enough discretionary money to give us a small grant to follow up.
I heard the sum was around $10,000, which is
around $10,000,
unbelievable
right.
that you've done this research.
So this is yeah. not really much money. It depends on your perspective. But for a dean at a state university, this was a lot of money. And, you know, deans at Auburn don't have war chests like maybe they do at Harvard or Princeton. This was a significant investment, but, yeah, again, I was really pleased that he had such faith in us. So we had a little bit of money to work with then, and what we did is we decided to work out of a remote camp down in the swamp. So in December, we basically set up a tent camp area. That was our home base for the whole winter.
Hmm.
And so this is primitive camping. There's certainly no water, no toilets. You're down in the swamp. We did bring down a gas generator so we could recharge our cameras and our listening stations and other key electric equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so Brian Rulick, who was basically my student, and Kyle Swiston, who was Dan's student, lived down there for over 4 months. I just found out recently that Kyle actually slept on the ground for the entire four-month period. Brian at least brought down a military cot, put in his tent, got up off the ground. But,
yeah.
Geez, it was rough. These guys are down there. Northern Florida is not Nebraska cold in the winter, but it was getting down into the mid-20s in some nights in the middle of winter. And he had to put up with giant rainstorms and other.
Well, that's a long time to be camping out there.
It is a long time. Mm-hmm. These guys are diehard. So
obviously,
basically, yeah. Kyle was in charge of listening stations,
mm-hmm.
and Dan built seven remote recording stations that we spread out through our study site. We worked in a small area about 1 mile wide and about 2 miles long,
mm-hmm.
and put our listening stations about 500 meters apart through this forested area.
Mm-hmm.
And these automated sound recording stations that Dan invented had to be visited every day because they had to have new batteries put in. We actually had to swap out batteries, and we had to swap out memory cards every day.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what Kyle did the whole winter.
Wow.
Kyle went to all seven stations every day. And this was a chore because these things are out in the swamp. You got to paddle and wade and slog your way to every one of these stations. And he's carrying these big, heavy batteries with him.
Hmm.
And then he gets these the memory cards, and he had to go back to his tent every day, get all the memory card information dumped onto his laptop computer, and then get it all organized and store it on external hard drive. I came down two or three weekends per month. I would spend my weekend searching for ivory bills, and then when I left, I would pick up one of these hard drives with all the information, come back to Auburn, and then transmit the information up to Dan's lab in Canada through the Internet.
You must have had some dedicated students or something, because there were literally, I think, thousands of hours worth of recording?
11,000 hours of recording,
I mean,
yeah.
you'd have
well,
to...
Well, this is a brilliant thing. A lot of people that do search automated sound files try to use computers that you set parameters for
okay.
what to look for,
mm-hmm.
and they automatically search the files. But
that helps.
That's very difficult. What we have in this case are weak sounds embedded in lots of background noise.
Right.
And so Dan actually had the idea that a human observer, I heard it lectured recently that what humans are really good at, what separates a human intellect from anything we can build in machines or anything else, is pattern recognition.
That's right, yeah.
Humans are very good at pattern recognition. And so Dan thought he could train undergraduate helpers to search for these signature patterns. That would be ivory bill sounds.
Which would be the two. It would be the double knock and then what they call the Kent call.
The Kent call, that's right. Mm-hmm. Each of those is a very... If you turn the sound into a picture, take the sounds and make them into a spectrograph, the picture of a double knock and a picture of a Kent call are very distinct
mm-hmm.
compared to other sounds that occur in the swamp.
Mm-hmm.
So these helpers of Dan's actually searched the sound files visually. They didn't listen to the sound.
Oh, I see.
Dan converted all the sounds into pictures, and these students would run through the hours and hours and hours of recordings as pictures. And as they ran through them, they'd be looking for these signature shapes.
Yep.
And that's how we scanned all 10,000 hours.
That's very clever.
It was brilliant. And it actually was cost-effective also because Dan hired these undergraduates as part-time helpers,
mm-hmm.
was able to involve undergraduates in the search, which was exciting, and really got cheap, high-quality sound analysis done.
That's very clever.
Yeah, humans are really visual animals, and the visual search of sounds is the way to go.
Mm, very clever. Now, also, you were looking for other indications, and you did come up with quite a few.
Yeah, so in the same forest where we saw birds, and by the end of this last summer, we had 14 sightings. In life, we heard birds, and by the end of last summer, we had 44 detections in life of Kent calls or double knocks.
Mm-hmm.
And the listening stations recorded almost 300, or they recorded over 300 of these signature sounds. And then we also, in the same spot, so we didn't go to different parts of the river for this, but right there, we also had numerous very large holes in trees. And ivory-billed woodpeckers create a hole in a tree, a cavity that's bigger than the pileated woodpecker, at least what's published on pileated woodpeckers. Indicates a significantly smaller cavity than ivory bill.
Now, are these nesting cavities? What are they using
cavities
for?
Uh-huh. They're holes in trees.
Okay, gotcha.
And from the old literature, the one time these birds were studied, they create a nest hole for nesting, a nest cavity, use it for nesting, and then never use it again.
Hmm.
That's not what they sleep in. Then they create separate cavities for sleeping, and they'll create many of these. And rotate between them.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is. You ask why would they do that potentially, and you'd say, well, when you have a nest and offspring, you tend to build up lots of parasites.
Mm-hmm. That's
actually,
right.
This was reported for nesting ivory bills, that they were just full of blood-sucking mites and stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's not a place where you'd want to sleep if you're an adult, if you could mm-hmm. avoid it. Or so they built a separate cavity that maybe they created in a way that was less vulnerable
very
to
interesting.
Yeah,
I was wondering why so many cavities, but that makes sense. They were
yeah.
more like roosting sites.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we figure each pair is going to bang out one or more nest cavities a year. For all we know, they make one and don't like it and then go make another one.
Mm-hmm.
And then each adult may have, in the old study, adults had, you know, seven or so cavities apiece to sleep in.
Hmm.
So that gets to be a lot of holes in trees.
Yeah, it does.
And plus, they don't go away. If they decide to build some new ones, dig some new ones this year, the ones from 2 years ago and 5 years ago and 10 years ago are still on the sides of trees.
Now, they also have a eating and scavenging behavior that's very distinctive that you might talk about, because that was the basis
of the old descriptions of how they fed is that they often feed like a regular typical woodpecker, bagging into soft wood. But one thing they did that was different than any other species in North America is they would scale thick, tightly adhering bark from recently dead trees. So all woodpeckers will knock bark off of a dead tree to look under, but when ivory bills were a very large, very powerful woodpecker with a bill that was flattened at the tip like a chisel, and they could strike this hard, tightly adhering bark and cleanly strike it away from the sapwood underneath. So they usually didn't make a mark on the sapwood. They simply knocked the bark off, and they were reported to do this to get at wood-boring insects that live in the sapwood under the bark.
Now, you found a lot of evidence of that debarking.
We saw a lot of that, and I had never seen anything like that before, and I spent a lot of time in southern forests. And what we found was really curious is we had come up to a tree where there would be maybe five or six areas where bark had been struck off, and these are often pretty small, you know, about as big as your hand maybe, or a little bigger. And almost invariably, at the center of these bark strikes would be the hole where a wood-boring insect had been, which we still find curious. So how do, and then if you scale the bark off the rest of the tree, you'll find those happen to be the only places where there was a wood-boring insect.
Wow.
So how do they know where to strike the tree to find these insects? We speculate they might hear these insects chewing and use sound to direct their strikes.
But that's
pure speculation. There has to be some way that they direct these, because they're not random.
And were there any other field cues that you relied on?
Any other evidence that these birds are around?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the five lines of evidence. The sightings and sound detections, the recordings that we've got, big holes in trees, and this bark scaling of trees.
Well, what's interesting to me, it sounds like a pretty strong case being made that those are the field marks for the ivory-billed woodpecker.
Uh-huh.
What I'm curious about, you, in terms of the site that you chose, you basically mapped out 1 square mile, but that habitat extends how far beyond that? So
It's a big forest.
Okay, so there could be, quite honestly, within that area, quite a population, conceivably.
There could be.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We actually, after we had pulled camp and called an end to our official field season at the end of April, Brian drove Kyle home to Canada. Then Brian took a much-deserved break back to Pennsylvania. I think he was gone for 2 weeks. And then he got back to Auburn towards the end of May, and I'd been working on the manuscript. I'd been in the office a lot, so we were anxious to get back out in the swamp. So Brian and I went on a little exploratory trip 10 miles north of where we'd been working. And on this first day in this new area, Brian had an ivory bill fly across the creek channel right in front of him. Got a clear view of this bird. And we think that has to be a different bird. Now, some people could argue that 10 miles north, it's not impossible that it was the same as one of the two birds that we'd seen down south. But I would bet that that's a third bird.
It's obvious.
We have evidence of three birds in two different areas now.
Well, and we really don't have information about the imagined range of these birds in terms of their territory.
Some very, very rough estimates from the old literature. But we know they probably cover a pretty big area. But what's pretty big? Some people think they may need 20 square miles per pair. That seems excessive.
That's
huge. Bird almost couldn't exist on Earth with that big of an area.
It'd be hard to
Some
imagine.
Some people think it could be as small as, you know, 4 square miles per bird. That's about the lowest people propose.
Well, obviously, there has to be a population. You don't just have two birds isolated of male and female.
We have evidence that we've seen three birds. That is a population. But if people get interested, is it a viable population?
That's
if we come in on ivory bills, as they peter out to nothing, Or if we come in on ivory bills, do they expand back to what they once were? Or if we come in on a population of ivory bills that was there, is there, is pretty much like they've always been. This river system just got missed.
Mm.
And, you know, we don't know.
Well, so where do you go from here?
Well, we haven't proven the existence of ivory bills yet.
No, you haven't.
There are skeptics that are going to say lots of indirect evidence does not add up to proof for an ivory bill. And we don't claim proof yet. Proof is going to be a clear picture or video, and that's our goal this year. That's our really our only goal. Everything else would start after we have proof positive that there's ivory bills in this river system.
Mm-hmm. Do you know when their breeding season would be, when they perhaps become more aggressive and making more calls?
Yeah, last year, I was in the swamp a bit in November and early December, and we had nothing,
mm-hmm.
no detections. And actually, so far in September this year, we have no detections. So I think the fall and early winter is a really tough time. I think they, what little evidence we have, they go silent. And that's what some of the previous the biologists from when they used to exist say, too. Now, last year, we started getting really a good rate of encounters in the last few days of December.
Hmm.
And interestingly, that's just when lots of birds here in the south start to get active. So I usually hear my first cardinal of the year sing in my yard sometime in late December. I hear the first woodpecker drum in my neighborhood somewhere in that late December, early January period. And that's what we seem to see ivory bills starting to get vocal and making their double knots at that time.
Well, it's very interesting, and I agree you haven't exactly proven this, but you've got an adventure laid out ahead of you. It sounds like a lot of fun. I wish I was a field biologist.
It is. That's the best part of it. It gives me many days in my kayak in the swamp,
exactly.
Which I really enjoy.
Wow, that's so interesting. If fate should shine on you, you will at some point here get at least a video and some excellent recordings and things of that nature.
Yeah, very likely will be a remote camera image. Really boring, black and white, but indisputable image. I'm afraid the next thing may be pretty anticlimactic, but that's where we're going to need a lot of remote cameras monitoring holes in trees and feeding trees.
Well, that's true. That's interesting, too. I love the science for this reason.
Yeah.
Now you have identified all of these holes. Now you set up the remote imaging systems monitor those, and you may get that would be a...
That's our best shot.
That's
last
exciting.
Year, mm-hmm. we had no equipment money. It was basically Brian most of the time, or Brian and me, slogging out in the dark in the morning to get to a cavity to watch it to see if anything came out of it. You know, we had a list of over 100 cavities, so we were watching about 1% or 2% per day.
Well, now, for people in that area who may have an interest, of course, this is going to create a whole new interest.
Right.
And birders are going to be flocking to that area. Let's talk about how they should appropriately help you out.
Yeah, well, the main way they can help us is to stay out of our study site. And it's a kind of a funny thing. We're not announcing where our study site is, and then we're asking everyone to stay out of it. But I have a feeling that it's soon going to become a poorly kept secret where we're doing our study. It's probably going to end up on the Internet. It's really not going to be that hard to find out where we are. So we're asking birdwatchers not to come in on top of our effort to document these birds in our one small area.
Mm-hmm.
So on the website that we've launched, I give 7 areas where I recommend birdwatcher search that wouldn't have any negative impact on us.
Mm-hmm.
And these are areas where nobody has yet sighted an ivory bill or heard an ivory bill, but the forest in these areas is excellent, and we have big cavities in these forests and scaling on the sides of trees. There's a good likelihood that ivory bills could exist in any of these places.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, as well, they should bring along cameras and recording
definitely
equipment.
Bring along cameras. I'll tell you what they should bring along. A map, a good topo map, and a GPS and make sure they know how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
This is a rough area. Many birdwatchers are used to, you know, walking on trails, working out of information centers and stuff. This is a rough place. If people try to figure out how to float around in a kayak or canoe in this swamp, they're going to be airlifted out of there. You can get yourself very lost very fast. And when the water comes up, which can be as soon as we get a decent rain, it's a river that flows right through the forest. There's swirling water everywhere. It's actually a pretty rough place. So I worry about some bird watchers getting so excited about the woodpecker they put themselves in a dangerous situation.
Give us that website too.
Okay, it's www.auburn.edu/ivorybill. All one word, no hyphen, ivorybill.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you're encouraging people to go out there.
We're not saying don't come to this river basin and look for birds. We're saying be careful and don't come in on top of our one site, 2 square miles out of this area, which has something like 60 square miles of forest.
It would seem that documenting these cavities would be a really strong addition to your work.
But mostly if bird watchers can get in there and get cat call and double knock detection, that corroborates what we're doing. More and more skilled birders keep hearing this thing. You have to start explaining how so many people could detect it. And then additional sightings by competent birders will just make our case stronger and stronger. And, of course, if some lucky birder could get a definitive video of this thing or a still picture, that would be a tremendous aid to us.
That's the jackpot.
Then we would have our proof that birds exist here, and we could move on with management plans and what have you.
Well, let's hope that exactly that happens.
Because that would be so exciting. I guarantee it'll be a fun swamp experience. There's not many places left in North America where you get a big swamp wilderness like this.
Well, Dr. Jeffrey Hill, thank you so much for your work and as well for joining us here on the Wild Side News. And I wish you great success in this upcoming season of field research.
Oh, well, thank you. And thanks for your interest in our work.
You bet. Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Bye. It's great to know that this country has deep, dark woods and swamps where the needy, greedy cleverness of man still must give way to the wild. And that's a good thing, because in many parts of our country, the battle to save our wild places, specifically the wilderness areas on public lands, are leading to an increasingly vituperative debate between the most dedicated advocates for wilderness. It's important that you keep listening to your voice of the earth, because the future depends on you. We'll be right back.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Wilderness advocates are a dedicated lot, preserving that which is pristine, which enshrines the greatest wonders and values of the living realms, inspires great passion. So it was inevitable that when strategies for success take divergent paths, it would lead to a clash of passions. We hear another side to the wilderness debate when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News. A few weeks back, the Wildside News went to the wilderness with Doug Scott of the Campaign for Wilderness and up to Idaho to talk about the successes expected in setting aside 300,000 new acres of wilderness, then off to the westward shores of the Pacific and the North Coast Wilderness Heritage Act that brought together various factions in a compromise legislation that has gained wide support. But there are those who see these not as real victories, but rather a compromise to the political climate that forces changes to interpretations of the Wilderness Act. During the next two segments, we talk with George Nickus, Executive Director of Wilderness Watch, who warns that such actions may in fact lead to inroads, both literal and figurative, into the legendary Wilderness Act that was set up to forever maintain the pure sanctity of the wilderness. As the legislative year comes to a close, there's going to be a lot of action that happens following a short break here at the end of the legislative year. And what that usually means is that a lot of bills get rammed through rather quickly. And in some cases, there's a lot of compromises that are formulated to try to make that happen. People in the wilderness community are concerned about what may be happening towards the end of this legislative year, and therefore have sent out an open letter to the conservation community calling for a moratorium on damaging public land and wilderness legislation. This is signed by 80 different environmental groups, particularly those concerned with wilderness and public lands. To help us understand the importance and the significance of this open letter, we're now talking with the executive director of Wilderness Watch, George Nickus. George, welcome to the Wildside News.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on the program, Sydney. Thank you.
First of all, why don't you give us a little background on Wilderness Watch?
Wilderness Watch is a national citizens organization that is uniquely focused on ensuring that lands that are in the National Wilderness Preservation System, our nation's wilderness areas, are protected and managed in a way that preserves those wild characteristics that which they were designated. We work on issues in wilderness all over the country, from Florida to Alaska, from Minnesota to California, and trying to make sure that this wonderful wilderness heritage that we have set aside in the United States is preserved forever.
The original Wilderness Act had some very strong provisions in terms of what was allowed and what was not allowed in wilderness areas, and I think that gets to the heart of some of this current concern. Why don't you first of all describe how you wish to see wilderness preserved?
Well, you're right. The Wilderness Act of 1964, which established the wilderness system and designated the first, nearly 10 million acres of wilderness in the country, is a very restrictive piece of legislation. It's written with the full intention and the legal mandate that the wilderness character of these areas has to be preserved. And it provides for a lot of different uses of those areas: hiking, camping, fishing, hunting, lots of recreational opportunities, but that everything that occurs in these areas must happen in a way that preserves their wilderness character for both present and future generations, and to keep them as secure habitats for a lot of the species, both endangered and otherwise, that need that kind of habitat to survive. So it was a very forward-looking document. It's incredibly unique in the world, really, because it established for the first time a statement by a people and a government that said, you know, some places we're just going to leave alone. We're going to let nature do its thing. We're going to let nature roll the dice, and we're going to accept the outcomes of that and appreciate it and study it and learn from it. But that it was really sort of nature's bill of rights. Some places we're just going to leave alone as human beings. And that was a really novel idea. It took 8 years to get that bill passed through Congress, many, many hearings and a lot of public support, but ultimately it passed Congress almost unanimously. And I think there was just a real strong feeling that that was a wonderful idea. And it's that idea of having these areas set aside where nature reigns and people visit, but we don't modify them, we don't change them, all of those kinds of things that makes the wilderness system so popular still. And in order to do that, of course, it requires restraint on the part of visitors and on the part of managers and others to not manipulate these areas, to not harm these areas, to not do inappropriate things. The Wilderness Act prohibits motorized vehicles. It prohibits any sort of mechanized transportation. It prohibits structures and installations. It prohibits road building. It does a lot of things like that to make sure that these areas are kept wild long into the future.
For close to 40 years, it seems as if that legislation was fairly sound and intact. But then the concern within the larger environmental community is that something began to change with the current administration, and there began to be really quite a concerted effort to start to create inroads, in literal and figurative words, into this legislation and the protections. Let's talk about that a bit.
Well, that's true, Sydney, and it You know, it may even predate this administration. I think it really goes back to probably the early 90s when the leadership in Congress changed. And even though the Wilderness Act and the wilderness system has always received very, very bipartisan support in the country, a number of folks became in charge of important committees, et cetera, in Congress, who had stated from time to time that they wanted to rewrite the Wilderness Act, or they thought the Wilderness Act was too restrictive. They wanted to allow a bunch of activities that had heretofore been considered inappropriate to occur inside of wilderness. And in specific cases, we started to see legislation that was geared at weakening protections of individual wilderness areas. For example, in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness up in the North Country of Minnesota, there was a legislative rider attached to a transportation bill, totally unrelated bill, but they attached a rider that allowed these motorized portages in the wilderness where you could actually take trucks into the wilderness and haul boats from one lake to another lake. And that was the first time that we saw the protection for an individual wilderness weakened. We've seen other situations since then on the Cumberland Island Wilderness, which is the largest undeveloped barrier island off the eastern seaboard. It's down off the coast of Georgia, a wonderful place. But in the last session of Congress, we saw the area carved up by roads through legislation, where they actually took this one intact wilderness area and divided it up into several areas and are allowing motor vehicles to travel on these corridors in between the areas. So we've seen those kinds of problems crop up in the wilderness system. It's very troubling because, you know, in the preamble to the Wilderness Act of 1964 talked about we were going to set aside areas for the permanent good of the whole people. The whole idea being that once we established an area as wilderness and designated it as wilderness, it was going to be preserved forever. It was a real pact with the future, if you will, a contract with the future that we'd preserve these areas. But we've seen that starting to be whittled away. Now what we see, which is a little bit of a different problem in some of these new wilderness bills, and one of the key reasons that we've called for and joined with these other 80 organizations in calling for a moratorium on some of these bills, is that these bills that are designating new wildernesses are including all kinds of special provisions, all kinds of compromises that allow things to occur inside of wilderness that are really counter to the Wilderness Act and what it sought to achieve. And we're very concerned, and we've seen this as in our day-to-day work of trying to preserve these areas that are already designated. We see how these special provisions are really eroding the idea of wilderness and that sanctity of the wilderness system and what it means. And so we're very concerned because a lot of these new provisions in these so-called wilderness bills are changing the nature of what wilderness is about. So there's a lot of things happening out there that are putting these special places at risk.
What is evolving is quite a debate within the wilderness community itself, where although the intentions are the same, and that is to set aside and preserve these miraculous lands for all time in a pristine form, some would say that from a practical standpoint, we have to make certain types of compromises in order to succeed at some level. And I guess this begins to define what the current debate is about, which is this concept of the quid pro quo approach to wilderness preservation. I think from my perspective, what it comes down to is a war over public lands and taking away public lands and also opening them up to more and degrading uses, just as almost a strategy such that if you get your foot in the door, well, probably it's very hard to turn it back. From your perspective, is this a well-organized attempt to kind of soften all of the public lands legislation?
Absolutely. It's an orchestrated effort, and it goes back quite a long time. There was an organization, the program listeners will be familiar with the term the Wise Use Movement, which started really getting some legs tundra back in the 1980s with the Sagebrush Rebellion and some of those efforts to roll back all the public land protections. And it was heavily funded by some of the extractive industries, and they used to put some citizen groups as front groups out there to make it look like a grassroots effort, but it was really being funded by the mining and logging and other industries. And it's morphed into a lot of different organizations. One of them was a group called the Wilderness Act Reform Coalition. And the Wilderness Act Reform Coalition put out a sort of its manifesto, and it listed something like 26 points that it wanted to achieve. And many of those points are starting to show up in wilderness bills today. These folks have been at this for a long time, and they're patient. And they use their connections on the inside, and they wait until the political winds are blowing the way they want them to blow, and then they strike. And they're striking in a number of these so-called wilderness bills or public lands bills, quid pro quo bills, as you referred to them, where they're getting their way through these new pieces of legislation. You know, the former Secretary of Interior, Stuart Udall, who was Interior Secretary when the Wilderness Act was passed, once said that, you know, the Wilderness Act will never be repealed. It's just too popular as a law. But what will happen is we'll see efforts to chip away at it one piece at a time. And that's exactly what we're seeing here, are efforts to chip away at that one piece at a time. It's not just the Wilderness Act. It's public lands in general, and you alluded to that, and it's so true that the whole idea that we're using our public lands as sort of bartering chips in order to get other things done, they're being used as sort of chattel to buy political favors in some of these wilderness bills, where our public lands are being given away to private development interests. And what Congress is doing, though, and what is really sort of nefarious here, is that they're attaching wilderness designations to these bills that otherwise would be seen for what they are. They're just development bills. They're giveaway bills. They're very, very, very poor public legislation. And they're putting in some wilderness designations to give them a green veneer and to try to buy off support from some of the conservation community and to minimize the opposition to these bills by some of the conservation community. And that's just really, really unfortunate. And what makes matters even worse is that even those wilderness designations that are included aren't real wilderness. They're not authentic wilderness. They're allowing all kinds of things to occur in these areas that would not normally be allowed. So, there are things like, many of us recently were alarmed when the state of Idaho proposed to go into the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness, which is the largest wilderness in the lower 48. They wanted to go in with helicopters and dart wolves, these wild wolves, inside their dartum land, collar these wolves, get collars on them, so that they could go back in later and find all the wolf packs in there when they wanted to wipe them out. And, everybody was just up in arms that they were going to do this and saying, you can't do that, it's wilderness, you can't go in there with helicopters and dart all the wolves. And yet there's legislation in Idaho right now to designate part of the Boulder White Clouds as wilderness, and some of the Owyhee country's wilderness, that would allow that very thing to go on. So we're seeing folks who can't achieve what they want to achieve because of the Wilderness Act starting to implement special provisions in new bills that would allow them to do that sort of stuff. And this isn't, you know, as you mentioned earlier, this isn't something that is just now happening. It's something that these groups have been working toward, these anti-wilderness, sort of anti-public lands groups, have been working toward for a long time. And we first saw it in a wilderness bill in Oregon several years ago, back around, 2000. And then it started popping up in Nevada, a couple of bills that have passed in Nevada, the Clark County bill and the Lincoln County bills in Nevada, had all of these kinds of provisions, and now we're seeing them in the Boulder White Clouds, the so-called Central Idaho Economic Development and Recreation Act is putting all these special provisions in. We're seeing it in a Washington County bill in Utah now, a White Pine County bill in Nevada again, and now in the Owyhee Canyonlands country of Idaho. So it's not just a quirk that we're seeing a couple things. It's not an anomaly. It's a pattern that's been developing for a long time.
The strategy by this side, when we're talking about public lands, people who are really trying to take the public lands out of the public domain in one way or another, they realize oftentimes that to do it directly is not going to fly. So unfortunately, and it's been a very effective, a brilliant, rather secret strategy, is to change things through administrative fiat or through changing regulations as opposed to through legislation. And I guess that gets at the heart of this, that what is happening is that for example, a wilderness bill can be, that is, as you say, is designating land that really doesn't qualify for wilderness, but it sets that precedent, and that's a bad precedent to set, because then that becomes the basis for looking back at another time and saying, well, look, it was done here, it was done here, it was done here, and that's the danger. And I think that gets to what your open letter is about, and that is that you really are trying to make people aware of the fact that we must hold to the original concept of wilderness, particularly right now.
Absolutely. You know, now, unfortunately, is not a good time to be passing wilderness bills, because we have a leadership in Congress and in the administration that is almost anathema to wilderness. They don't believe in it, they don't like it, and the point that they're making to the conservation community is that if you want wilderness, you're going to have to pay a very heavy price for it. And many of us are looking at that and saying the price isn't worth it. For one reason, in most situations, if the areas aren't designated today, they're not going to disappear tomorrow. We'll have another chance. The political winds will change, whether it's this year, next year, 5 years from now. It will happen. There will be more support for wilderness. We'll have opportunities to get wilderness bills that do justice to the idea of wilderness and to the wilderness system. But what we have right now is a situation where Congress is exacting a very high price. And sometimes you have to step back and say there are many other ways to protect these lands without designating them wilderness today, and we need to put our efforts in that direction. And when the opportunity is right, that's when we'll get additional wilderness. And wilderness always has. Most, even though the wilderness system today is now 100 million acres in size, it tends to come in lumps. It tends to come at times when the planets get aligned just such and there's an opportunity and you get good legislation through. Now just isn't one of those times. People are using these bills to promote all kinds of agendas that aren't in the public's interest and certainly aren't in the interest of public lands.
Give us some examples of these trade-offs that you find most egregious.
I would probably put the most egregious things into three categories. One of them is the outright giveaway of public lands, which the Central Idaho bill does. It gives public lands to local communities so that they can then sell those lands for private development. So basically, we're using our public lands in order to fund local projects. In other cases, the federal government, the public lands are being sold in these bills. The agencies are being told to sell these certain parcels of land, and then that money comes back, and a portion of that money is used to fund local projects. So essentially, we're using our public lands as a cash cow for local communities, et cetera, and private developers in order to make money. And I think, you know, that's the very thing that the public screamed about when the Bush administration came out with a proposal earlier this year to sell some of our national forest lands in order to pay for the communities impacted by the lessening of the harvest of timber on public lands and to help support schools and all in those communities. And people said, our public lands aren't out there to be sold to pay for programs that we ought to be, if they're worthy of funding, we ought to be funding in other ways. So the selling and giving away of public lands is a huge problem. A second big problem, and the one that our organization is focused on are some of these provisions that allow motor vehicle use inside of wilderness, snowmobiles, ATVs, helicopters, airplanes, etc. in wilderness, that allow these kinds of manipulative actions with respect to wildlife and also with the control of fire, where it would allow local communities, counties, state governments, etc. to make decisions about firefighting, etc. in these wilderness areas. And so, that'll be very destructive. It's a guarantee. And then, but there's also a third thing, and it's related to that in a sense, that what some of these bills do, such as this Owyhee Canyons bill, is we talked a few minutes ago about the old Sagebrush Rebellion and the efforts back in those days to actually transfer federal lands to state and local governments. Well, that failed. The public screamed bloody murder about that. So what they're trying to do is get control of them in another way. And so what they're doing in these bills is they're creating local management committees and local management teams of local people, like local ranchers, local landowners, etc., that become advisory teams to the federal government at the local level, and they set policy for how our public lands will be managed. And so if they can't shift ownership of the land, they've essentially shifted control of those lands to these local entities to make decisions. And so it goes right back to the provision I mentioned with wilderness, where they're going to allow local and state agencies some control over fire management in these places. In other instances, they're simply granting a lot of the decision-making responsibilities on public lands to these local-based steering committees and steering teams that the legislation's establishing. And they're always jam-packed with special interest groups that have their own, you know, personal interest involved by what the decisions that are made there. So it's kind of shifting the control of our public lands toward more private interests and local government interests. So I think those are three of the biggest problems with the way these new bills are being written and the kinds of things that they would allow.
We're taking a short break, and we'll continue our discussion with George Nickus when your Voice of the Earth returns.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
What lies ahead in the struggle to keep the sacred wildlands for all future generations? Will compromise ultimately lead to a compromised landscape? Will changing a few definitions cloud the pure vision? There is a real world assembly of opposing viewpoints meeting in the tall trees of the great forests. It's time to talk. We continue our discussion with George Nickus after this short break. We now continue our discussion about the future of America's wilderness with the Executive Director of Wilderness Watch, George Nickus. It's a very clever strategy that's been used in so many different arenas right now in terms of management, ownership, transfer of ownership of our public lands. And it's so subtle, and it very often is couched in such a manner that it all sounds perfectly logical and reasonable. But unfortunately, the outcome is, again, a diminution of the real protections that the Wilderness Act and other legislation has provided for our public lands. Well, that's why you've really raised a clarion call right now in terms of this letter asking for a moratorium. Let's talk about why that is so important to you at this time.
The reason that it's so important right now is because we are facing a host of bills that are being rushed through Congress as we speak, really, to try to get a whole slew of these bills passed. I mentioned four of them in particular a minute ago in Idaho, and two of them in Idaho, one in Nevada and one in Utah. And we're very concerned that what often happens in Congress, especially as you get toward the end of a congressional session, is members of Congress start attaching some legislation to other pieces of legislation in order to hurry up and get it through, legislation that on its own may not be able to garner enough support to get passed, like some of these wilderness bills. But if they attach it to some other bill, like an appropriations bill or some other popular bill, maybe it's funding the war in Iraq, or maybe it's funding some sort of homeland security provision, then they'll attach their bill to that, and it makes it basically veto-proof. It makes it so that everybody's going to vote for it, whether they like it or not, because of the legislation it's attached to. And we're very concerned that we're going to see these very egregious public lands bills attached to legislation that is sort of must-pass legislation in Congress, and it will get rushed through. And unfortunately, Sydney, there are a handful of conservation organizations that are supporting these bills that have decided that being able to put the wilderness label on some of these additional lands, regardless of what might be inside the can, they want the wilderness label on there, and they're willing to take all of these other bad provisions, all of these public land disposal provisions, etc., in order to get some wilderness designated. And it's their support for these bills that is being used by some of these members of Congress to put enough greenwashing on things that they think they can get the bills passed. And we're just asking our colleagues to take a time out. Let's pull back from pushing these very destructive bills, these very harmful bills, and let's have a little more discussion within our community about these. They're very divisive within the conservation community, and that's the really unfortunate part as well about it, because it is causing a lot of splintering within a movement that doesn't need splintering. But we're asking that if we could just get a timeout on some of these bills to talk through some of these deleterious provisions. And hopefully, you know, we may even have a better Congress to work with in the future on some of these things. And so if we just take a time out now, maybe we can fix some of these harmful provisions, we can get rid of them, and we can promote good, solid wilderness bills that don't compromise a lot of other public land values.
Let's say that we could have that discussion behind closed doors. What would you throw on the table? What do you feel needs to be discussed? Let's talk about maybe two or three points.
I think we have to stop compromising the public land law gains that we've made in the past, specifically the Wilderness Act. We need to stop allowing this chipping away, this creeping degradation of that law, and make sure that wildernesses that are added in the future Don't come in with a lot of baggage that is harming the wilderness system. We have public land laws that deal with things like land exchanges and ways that local communities who need some public land, maybe for a waste disposal site, maybe for a public park, maybe for a fire station, who knows what. We have laws on the books that provide for those kinds of things to be considered and taken care of in a way that protects the public interest. We don't need to be undercutting those laws and skirting those laws with legislation. The reason it's often done with legislation is because a lot of these provisions wouldn't pass the smell test. And if they had to go through any sort of public scrutiny and public process, they'd be seen for what they are. But if you can rush them through a legislative process, you've gotten around all those other concerns. So if we could just come to some consensus about the need to uphold the sanctity of all of these public land statutes that people have worked so hard to establish over the years and keep those in place and not compromise that through these public land bills, then I think we can make a lot of progress. You know, conservationists have always had a lot of disagreements about what ought to be designated as wilderness, but we didn't argue about what wilderness is, and now in these bills we're starting to argue about what wilderness is, and we're allowing all kinds of things that aren't consistent with wilderness to be included. We've always held that public lands were sort of a sacred trust handed down to us and that we need to pass on undiminished to future generations. That's been one of the bedrock philosophical underpinnings of the conservation movement. And yet that seems to be going out the window. And I think we need to sit back and think about what it is that we're trying to achieve with all of these bills and how we can do it in a way that doesn't begin to compromise the very foundation of what makes America so great and what has always made the United States a real leader in world conservation, and this the whole notion of our public lands and our public domain and our Wilderness Act and our Endangered Species Act and these kinds of laws that have really, you know, made our country stand out. Before we start compromising those away, we ought to have a discussion about what it is we're giving away and why.
I guess my concern is the fact that I think you're up against a really difficult 6 weeks ahead here, because they think there's a huge momentum that's going to move forward to get a lot of this legislation, and that these very likely are going to go through the process you've defined. They're going to be attached to larger bills, and what do you think the real chances are? I mean, I can certainly appreciate your thought. You basically are kind of saying, let's pull these out, be aware. There's a chance there could be a change in November, at which point let's regroup and move forward. But what do you think is really going to happen?
Well, I mean, part of the problem is, of course, almost, you know, some of these bills, in fact, I don't know that any of them have ever had a field hearing. I don't think any of them have had a hearing out in the field, which is a very common thing for public lands legislation. Some have had very abbreviated hearings in Congress. They're all being rushed through. I think that you're absolutely right that we're up against a tremendous challenge here, which is why folks have taken this unprecedented move of calling for a moratorium. And I think it's why, in a matter of just a few days, 80-plus organizations signed on to it. I think we understand, you know, we face a tremendous challenge here, but it's not an insurmountable challenge. And I think that if people get on the phone to their senators in particular, because most of these bills are through the House and sitting in the Senate right now, get on the phone to their representatives, get on the phone to their senators, and tell them they don't want these bills to be considered, they don't want these bills to be passed, that they want a timeout on this kind of legislation. I think it's very possible to stop them, but we're not naive about the difficulty of that challenge. It is going to be huge. There's a lot of impetus behind them, and they're right now in Congress. The leadership of the various committees, et cetera, that get to decide what bills come up and which ones don't are not particularly favorable toward wilderness, and liked many of these bills because they do many of the sort of destructive things that we've been talking about. But it's very possible to stop these things. It's just going to take some public outcry. It's going to take people standing up for their public lands, speaking out for their public lands, contacting their representatives in Washington, D.C., saying, I don't want these quid pro quo wilderness bills going anywhere.
Now, in your moratorium, you've literally outlined the four bills that you consider to be most critical. Why don't you go ahead and mention those, and then we'll follow that up with how people can find out more.
The four bills in particular is one is it's called the Central Idaho Economic Development and Recreation Act, CEDRA. Another one in Idaho is the Owyhee Initiative. That's in southwestern Idaho. Another one is the White Pine County legislation for White Pine County in Nevada. The other is a Washington County bill in Utah, which deals with some of the area in southwestern Utah.
Now, at this point, you expect those to be attached to legislation that may be rammed through at the end of this legislative session?
It's hard to say, but it's very likely that that's what will happen in order to get them through, that they'll get attached to something else. They may all get bundled together and go along with a few other bills that people like. One of the things that sometimes happens in Congress, unfortunately, is that deals are made, and everybody agrees to hold their nose and let the other person's bill through if they'll hold their nose to let their bills through, you know, and there's those kinds of trades that are made, and what we're really asking is that they not make that kind of a deal with these bills, that we don't see anything in Congress that is good enough that it's worth allowing these bills to go through in order to let those other bills pass.
My effort here on the Wild Side News is to inform and let democracy move forward. And so, therefore, as this goes out to various players in the wilderness and public lands community, I encourage them to take a look at all sides and then act however you feel most appropriate. For people who wish to learn more of the specifics or to get more directly involved, what's the best way for people to do so?
Well, I'll give them a couple of ideas. One is they can get a hold of us here at Wilderness Watch, and you can do that by email at just wild@wildernesswatch.org. Call us. You can go to our website, get all the contact information you need. Our website is wildernesswatch.org. If you want to look at a briefing paper that deals specifically with these four bills and what they do, I would direct them to the Western Lands Project's website, which is westernlands.org, and you can get to the briefing paper on the quid pro quo wilderness bills from there, and there's a lot of good information about it. You can contact our office, and we'd be happy to talk with them more about these bills.
Well, George, I tend to lean your way that I think we need to be extremely cautious and make sure that we're not just moving ahead for the sake of moving ahead. These are really serious battles that are out there, and they're very well orchestrated, particularly from the other side, at chipping away at what we hold so sacred. So it might be a good time to hold fast and take a deep breath and see what happens with this upcoming election, and have a great debate and talk about this and formulate our own strategy that is unified. I think that'd be a great way to move forward.
I think you're right about that, and you know, I think it even goes beyond these particular bills and all too. You know, there really is an effort afoot that is reshaping our relationship to our public lands and I think even to our government. The whole, with some of the budget mess that we're in and the defunding of public land agencies where and again by design people are saying let's cut out the funding for these agencies. Let's make them go out to the corporate world and basically beg for partnerships, beg for money in order to fund our public lands, whether it's keeping the campgrounds open or monitoring what's going on our trail systems or whatever it might be, there's just a tremendous effort to essentially get private industry deeper and deeper and deeper into our public lands management. And all of these bills we've been talking about are part of that whole scene. And I really think it's important that as a community, both as an environmental community and as a public at large, that we start thinking about what we want for these lands and what we're willing to do in order to protect them, and how we're willing to change our public policies, both at the budgetary levels and in these very specific pieces of legislation, to ensure that we're going to keep our public lands public, and we're going to keep this great American heritage of public lands and wilderness alive for future generations.
Well, George Nickus, Executive Director of Wilderness Watch, I want to thank you so much for your thoughts here on the Wildside News.
Well, Sydney, it's been a real pleasure to be on your program. Thanks so much for giving us the opportunity to speak with you.
It's a unique moniker, mankind. As we see the toll taken on the wild beings, as whole systems struggle to exist, we have a lot of hard questions that need all of us to speak up and speak out about. That's what we do each Thursday and every day on the archives, when your voice of the earth speaks up for the wildness. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again, here on the Wildside News.